Welcome to the Speaker's Corner Show. My name is Heiko Kuh. This week's show was recorded on Sunday the 22nd of February 2009 at Speaker's Corner. The show's broadcast every Tuesday at 6:30 p.m. on 104.4 Resonance FM. You can come down and join us at Speaker's Corner every Sunday between noon and dusk. And you can visit our website on www.speakerscorner.net.
Oh, you disagree with me, do you? After all these years.
Well, we never disagree at all.
Okay, go on, fire away.
Here's my point. Now, the BBC did come into existence at the turn of the 20th century.
Need television.
1925 or 1920?
Let me make my point.
This coincided with the decline of the British Empire.
Really?
So, no, it did. It did coincide with the decline of the British Empire. So, at the time,
the Indians. What was it used for?
The Indians were agitated for independence at the time. So to actually say that the BBC at the time had sought to, you know, converge with the ruling classes to, you know, dominate and destroy our lives.
They were all extremely posh.
Maintaining the status quo. Well, how could you possibly say so when our money generates their existence?
Our money generates their existence.
You can't say so entirely.
It's a reasonable question, may I respond?
Go ahead, my man.
First of all,
Firstly,
the time when the BBC was set up, the British Empire was at its pinnacle. The objective of the BBC was to maintain the status quo on a global scale. The BBC, I think you will accept, can I just respond to what you said? The BBC, I think you will accept, did not precipitate the collapse of the British Empire.
It merely reported
on the processes taking place around the world. The majority of its reporters around the world would have been the adventurers and the representatives of the middle class stratum of society, Oxford and Cambridge graduates or London University graduates in their exception, would have gone round the world to report on behalf of the British Empire how the British Empire is doing, with the idea of maintaining the British Empire. And by the way, the idea the British Empire has completely dissolved is disproven by the fact we're the only country in Iraq that still maintains the government in power that was responsible for the invasion of Iraq. We're the only country in the world which maintains the original justifications for the invasion of Afghanistan. The Americans have abandoned this policy. They don't argue this anymore. They've got new government, new Barack Obama, new world. We've got new Labour, old British Empire, still in power. And so the idea that the British Empire disappeared earlier in the 20th century is completely false. The British still seek to maintain imperial domination. And if you ask yourself what imperialism actually is, it is not simply the bullets and bombs of the British military machine. It is also the diplomacy of the British diplomatic corps. It is also the ideological indoctrination of the British mass media, in particular the BBC. It is also the cultural infiltration and legal influence of the British establishment on colonial and ex-colonial administrations all around the world, who emulated and structured their apparatus of power once there was decolonization on the British model, from Malaysia to Kenya to Uganda, to Egypt, to the Sudan, you name it. to some, to some US, degree, to some much, degree, elements much, within the US as well.
No,
elements
much,
within the United
US
States.
US is pretty much an Anglo-Saxon country.
So the idea, there is also,
right now, yes.
Above all else, there is also the influence of British financial domination alongside its former colony, the United States, the financial domination of the world, which controls industrial production around the entire globe. That, of course, is the key to understanding imperialism. They are stoking up the foundations for a massive increase in inflation in the future. Because all of you, on the one side, are going to be asked to tighten your belts and pay for the crisis created by the bankers and speculators. On the other side, you're also being asked that your children and your children's children will also have to tighten their belts in the future. One, because of global competition from the lower paid economies. Two, because the British and Americans and the Europeans are borrowing even more money to save their friends in the private sector who plundered and robbed the world for the last 20 years.
Let's have a bloody revolution.
That's the reality of the economic policies being advocated in the Western world today.
Is it a planned takedown?
Is it a planned takedown?
He's a
conspiracy. The Ponzi scheme.
That's all you ever see.
The Ponzi scheme
sort of
went off forever.
That's all you ever
talk about.
No,
a Ponzi scheme.
Some people have a mind. Some people at Speaker's Corner have a mind like that. But they always seek out. It must be someone to blame for this.
Shall we blame God?
If someone has a heart attack, maybe someone killed them. If an economy turns downwards, maybe someone organized the whole thing. If you trip up, maybe someone chucked something in front of your foot.
Yeah. Banana skin.
If your house went down in price that you bought in Bulgaria.
That's the Freemasons. It's the Freemasons, ain't it?
It must be a Jewish Freemason.
Freemasons.
Who messed up Bulgaria. So
wake up.
A little bit of flexibility of the mind is also useful. People from the middle classes who were doing quite well during the economic expansion.
Exactly.
You all know the people. Someone who bought a house,
I know.
Made some money on it,
sure.
Bought another house, rented a bit of it out, made some money, kept the job maybe didn't. Maybe he could go self-employed. Maybe he had 4 houses, or 6 houses, or 10 houses, rented them out to students, kept them in a nice nick though. But then suddenly, one of his houses is too expensive for the rent that's coming in. The other house can't quite cover itself either. And the little Ponzi scheme, the little rip-off scheme, the little pyramid scheme that he constructed for himself to pay for his pension, and to pay for his trips around the world and his good lifestyle, suddenly collapsed. That person has automatic propensity to conspiracy theory.
Yes.
Probably the most likely conspiratorial tendency in British society will be to blame, around the world actually, in the advanced capitalist countries, will be to blame the Muslim Jews. Because the Muslims, on the one side, are, after all, the terrorists and the foreigners. And the Jews, after all, are the ones who control the banking system and the financial operations. They have the largest position as a nation within the financial and economic system. That probably is true as a proportion. Proportional relationship to the population. That probably is true. And therefore the propensity to see that, if you like, as a reason for the problems in society is obviously there. The other people, of course, will be the communists, who at the moment are still quiet, but I understand they're on the way back at the moment. I understand there's a tendency in that direction around the world. For example, who organised that demonstration in Ireland yesterday? Who? Trade unionists. Who are the trade unionists They got some communist or socialist idea in their head.
Right?
Who are the people who organise the demonstrations in France?
It's the communists.
Coming back out the woodwork.
They like to have a riot in France.
The anarchists in Greece.
Who is it who organised the protests in Greece?
The anarchists.
The anarchists. Therefore, the lefty, communist, Bolshevik, Muslim Jews are undoubtedly the ones responsible.
Organised Christian.
You're
going
to have to say my time.
There's a difference in consciousness between the middle classes and the working class in relation to who's to blame. And why is that?
There is a distinction between the class itself as an objective category. That is, people who work for a living and earn a wage. Those you could call, in classical Marxist terminology, the working class. But within the working class, there are different gradations. There are sections of them who have raised themselves above the other, who have bought three or four houses, who consider themselves above the rest. There are sections of them who leave the working class and set up a little business, employ 5, 10, 15 people or more people. Make money by employing them, but they still got to work themselves. They might be upper managerial strata, earning 50, 60, 80, 100, 150,000 pounds when they go to work. They might work long hours, they might get ulcers, they might have problems. They don't own the means of production. They are therefore not the capitalists, and they are not the working class in a classical sense, in that they don't have the workers don't have the means to live, except social security, without working for a living. The middle classes, they might have a means just to get by, or earn a little bit more than the others. They might not have to work, they might have income from flats, apartments, houses, or small business, or stocks and shares. And so the different psychology within these different strata reflects itself in different processes in class struggle. People join different sides of disputes. Some people will say, when there's a demonstration, look at all those people protesting. Why don't they go and get a job? Some people will say, well, that's the upper stratum after all. The top, that was the aristocracy in France. Some people will turn around and say, well, given that there's an economic problem, let's look after our own. British people first, forget about the foreigners. Some people will say, we don't want Ethiopians, we want Europeans. Some people will say, we don't want Europeans, we want English only. And so the distinctions and divisions and the psychological impact which these processes have reflect themselves differently in each people. The key question is, how does the working class as a force, which is capable of changing society, how do they act and bring about an impact to galvanize the other layers of society? Society divides between the poles, between the capitalist class, who seek to create a new order on the basis of repressing and reducing the living standard of the workers. On the other side, the working class seek to maintain their living standards and advance them. In these conditions, the middle class will vacillate between the two.
Yeah, that's a great way.
He said about the working class is capable to bring about a change. So to change from this state to what? What would be the prospect, basically?
Mate.
That's a process, but what would be the end result? That's what I'm concerned.
The end result? Well, the process is a transformation of society. For example, the idea, the capitalist system itself is confronted by an internal crisis. How does it resolve that crisis? It seeks to resolve it, and it will seek to resolve it, by nationalization. Nationalization of the banks and protection of key industries, which they consider strategic for the maintenance of stability in society, because they fear revolt. Revolt, of course, can get out of hand, can lead to blood on the streets, and can lead to the loss of power and authority of the ruling classes. And therefore, they seek to control that the working class seek to establish, unconsciously move in this direction, to establish control of society and establish a society where their interests and the interests of the majority are the priority. And Iron Bevan used to say, socialism is the language of priorities. What do we mean by that? It means that the main interests of the majority, health, education, welfare, good living standards for the majority, stable working conditions, rights for the workers, a better living condition for the mass of the population worldwide, peace, freedom and plenty in harmony with the ecology. These are the fundamental aspirations of the majority of mankind.
In harmony with ecology.
And in order to establish this in a social system, it means you have to have the commanding heights of the economy. That means the key sectors which drive the economy, the banks, and through the banks, all the major industries in society, and transportation, and infrastructure, to be able to own them and plan what is done with those resources. That means in a country like Britain, the largest 150 companies that own about 70% of the assets of the country must be taken into public hands and democratically controlled in order to plan the development of society for the benefit of the majority, according to the priorities of the majority. That means, what does it mean by democratic planning? It means that the people democratically control the economy.
The workplaces first.
The economy should be publicly owned and democratically controlled, the commanding heights of it. The rest of it you can leave in private hands, because the banks, if they are state-owned, will get all the resources from the private sector anyway and can allocate those resources towards the priorities of the population.
I don't know much about politics, but you're talking about capitalism, and I know about traditional communism, as it was in the USSR, and there seems to be an emphasis on the means of production and on work and on economic growth. I think that we don't need more economic growth. What we need is redistribution. The West is sinking in the useless production of things, and there was the useless production of things in the USSR, and now there's the useless production of things in China. Things, and we can't keep on just using up the world's resources. And also the emphasis on work. Why work? There's this emphasis on work in the workers in capitalism, an emphasis on the workers in communism. Why not less work, less producing things, and more spending time people doing what they want to do, self-development, and stop destroying this planet by just producing economic growth,
The lady here makes some very important points. She says the economic growth in society is a squanderous growth. Well, it's undoubtedly true that a significant section of the economic growth under capitalism is squanderous growth. The creation of demand for demand's sake, in order to make profits, for the sake of making profits. Creating products that destroy themselves, self-destruct mechanisms within them, so that you can sell another one to them in a year's time or in 2 years' time. The classical example of the modern era is the mobile phone. More mobile phones in Britain than the entire population of Britain. They create them in such a way that they break down within 1 or 2 years, they replace them with another one. Because they paid, the mobile phone companies paid astronomical sums to purchase licenses to the airwaves. And they have to recover these income for the licenses for the airwaves, which should never have been sold in the first place. They are national and international strategic assets for the benefit of the population. So on the one side, there is a tendency within capitalism to produce useless commodities, perfectly correct. On the other side, you mustn't bend the stick, in my opinion, too far in the opposite direction, when huge swathes of the world's population do not have the basics of life. The provision of the basics of life, and the not only the basics, but the advanced level of infrastructure that we have in Europe, Japan, America, to people in Latin America, China, India, Africa, is one of the huge tasks mankind faces in development. What type of development we pursue is a very important question. Is it destructive to the environment? Is it destructive and purposeless in the way it's used? Is it orientated in such a way that it also involves or counts improvements in growth? Can be counted by increasing the amount of armaments we produce, for example. Obviously, the way in which the economy is developed and the capitalism is a negative way. On the other side, that doesn't negate the idea of economic growth. Economic growth must, however, be under the control of the democratic will of the population. Unless you own that economic infrastructure that controls humanity's economic and social activities, then you can't alter the way in which the economy is run. So this question that you approach cannot be dealt with without public ownership of the commanding heights of the economy and the banking system. Once we have that public ownership, then you can restructure society around the genuine needs and requirements of mankind, including a reorganization of work to serve the interests of the nature of human beings. And that is something yet to be defined, if you like. Human beings must create their identity, identify what they believe working lives should be, and what the distinction between work and leisure is. We have to create a society where our work is essentially indistinguishable from our volition, from what we would like to see in society, what we would like to do in society, where our work is a creative process to beautify the earth and to reorganize it for the benefit of all. Good afternoon.
Would you include as work a lot of work that is not actually paid at the moment, like, for example, raising children, caring for people? This is, a lot of the definition of work has been traditionally male-orientated, paid-for work, whereas actually a lot of work goes on that is not paid for, but is actually work.
The idea about what work is and what is useful work needs to be adjusted by a socially defined norm as what is useful and what is not useful. Then I believe you're correct. For example, in Venezuela, they passed the law that women's work in the home is counted as paid employment. And they pay women to do housework. And I believe that is the foundation. It is correct to do that, because that's the only way in which you can eliminate the idea of a woman's role in society and transform that to become an employer in an employment task for society.
How would you explain why work is categorized in the way that it is in society as it is now? Why isn't homemakers considered?
Capitalism is a system of production for profit. It produces commodities for profit. Where there is no profit to be made, the activity engaged in by people is not considered a useful activity under capitalism, generally.
What happens if you sell your children?
In some countries, selling your children is part and parcel of the capitalist system.
Selling babies in Romania.
After all, in Britain, the selling of children was also a normal activity in the 1850s. In Brick Lane Market, they used to sell babies. So there's nothing so unusual about that. And after all, people sell their organs to this day. You can sell one of your kidneys if you want. People sell their blood. People sell their sperm. Nothing so unusual. People sell their hair on their head. And people sell their labor power. So capitalism is a system that acquires profits from producing commodities for sale. That's the way the system operates. I've been speaking for a while, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to take a break. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Take one of our journals and visit our website, marxist.com.
He knew what God's purpose for mankind was.
Okay, God seemed to be on a higher authority on what God and said.
27, 28. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him.
I'm sorry for God.
Male and female, he created them.
It's not a very upbeat message,
this,
is it?
That was the Speaker's Corner show for this week. Come down to Speaker's Corner and join us any Sunday afternoon to speak, listen, or discuss. Visit our website on www.speakerscorner.net or tune in every Tuesday at 6:30 p.m. on 104.4 Resonance FM.